Hey, what's good? Bienvenidos. Welcome to the Mid-South Boogaloo Podcast, a podcast that serves as educational, creative, informative, and intellectual space for African Americans and Latinos alike, an effort to encourage unity, peace, knowledge, and creativity. And I'm your host, Alexander Parker. Following is a conversation between Ramel Strong and myself. Ramel Strong is a very intelligent and very talented individual. Ramel Strong has an immense background in business and finance and has danced mambo, bachata, and salsa for many years. In this episode, we spoke about a variety of things, including the heavy African-American involvement and influence on Latin music in New York, especially when it comes to Latin boogaloo, and what we currently know as salsa music. And we also spoke about equity, inclusion, dance as an idea and philosophy. How important it is for someone to experience new things and to travel and to expand themselves. And we also spoke about how Memphis, what things in Memphis have to be changed in order for Memphis to be fully uplifted, which cannot start without the acknowledgement, without certain people opening their eyes and realizing who makes up the majority? Who really lives in the city? Overall, it was just so great to have Ramel on this episode. Very exciting conversation. And I hope you guys enjoy this conversation as well. I know it's been a month since the initial launch and my birthday, and I'm so thankful for all of you who have been part of the journey. Hopefully, you all have had a chance by now to listen to the first two episodes, and I'm so excited to bring more content your way. All right, let's go. Vamos. All right, guys, this is episode 3 of the Mid-South Boogaloo Podcast, and I'm your host, Alexander Parker. And with me, I have Ramel Strong. And as my memory serves me, we met at a dance social a while back, a couple of years ago. And, you know, I've stayed in contact with him ever since, and he's always been kind to me, and he's also very talented, very, very talented. I just have this memory of, like, Ramel and his brother just coming through at a dance social, just like dominating the the room with their salsa, their mambo, and their bachata dancing. It's like, wow, these guys, these guys are like some ninjas, like dance ninjas or something, you know, masters.
Far too kind, it's very far too kind.
And yeah, I'm gonna go ahead and introduce Ramel a little bit. Let's see, Ramel. He is a instructor at Seda Latin Dance and for Baila Memphis. And also let me know if I mess up on any of these. And for many years, he's danced mambo, bachata, and salsa as well. And you're from Memphis, but you lived in Florida and you also lived in New York. And you went to Florida A&M University, DePaul University, and Kansas University. Kansas State University. And you have a lot of degrees and certifications. You have a MBA in business administration. You have a master of science, wealth management. And you have a certificate in financial therapy. And you have a doctorate of philosophy degree in personal financial planning.
Working on that one.
Okay. And you're a certified financial planner and you have a certificate in investment performance measurement. I never thought that was a thing. Investment performance measurement.
Trust me. It's a very, very, what's the word I want to use? Boring and process driven a part of the business, but you learn a lot about the investment business in terms of how we present performance metrics. And what you realize is that everything is an estimate. It's just our best estimate that we can create based on some guidelines. So.
And let's see. And then you're now a wealth strategist at Trust Company.
So I'm actually was a most recently employed by a company called Diversified Trust here in Memphis.
Okay.
And I severed my relationship with them in February, so last month. I am in the process of working through some more certifications and licensing. And so I do have a new employer, but until I do what I'm supposed to do in order to be able to actually serve our clients, I'm keeping that a little bit under wraps. So it gives me a little bit of drive to get it done quickly so I can, you know, talk about my new firm.
Okay. Sounds good. And yeah, that's all I got. Ramel Strong. And so Ramel, but also Ramel, I want you to speak on that. You know, I want you to tell the folks a bit more about you, where you're from, your hobbies, your interests. How did you get into land and dancing, and what has that done for you?
Absolutely. So I'm, of course, as Alex stated, first, thank you for inviting me on your podcast. I'm very
Yeah, of course, man. Yeah.
Grateful to be asked to participate in this capacity. Yeah, but I was born and raised in Memphis. I grew up in East Memphis, graduated from White Station High School, ended up going to Florida A&M, aka FAMU. Spent several years connected with the university, but it's where I got my bachelor's and my master's in business administration. Spent some time in Orlando, as well as Norfolk on internship, Norfolk, Virginia. And then I actually did a summer up in New York, which would have been circa 2009. And then okay. When I finished school, I went to live in Chicago. Spent about 8 months in Miami, but eventually kind of set down roots there in Chicago for a minute. And so was there from 2010 to 2018, and then moved back here to Memphis in large part to pursue my doctorate in personal financial planning. As far as my dance journey, it's been a very interesting one. So my older brother, Corey Strong, he's been dancing for the better part of two decades. And so my kind of journey is happens in fits and starts. I want to say it was probably 2005, 2006. He tried to introduce me to salsa. Had a friend of his kind of try to teach me the basic step. It did not take. And so I kind of left it alone. And then I was in Norfolk. This would have been circa 2008. So the fall of 2008, there's not a lot that goes on in Norfolk, Virginia. So trying to figure out a kind of a pastime and a way to find some community there. So I learned my basic at a place called the Mambo Room in Norfolk. It's in an area called Ghent, which is their one of their kind of high society, if you will, areas in the city of Norfolk. People are really, really great. You know, exposed me to some things. It's actually the place where I met one of my good friends, Leah Patterson, for the first time. She's in North Carolina, but she came up to perform. And again, I was, you know, just taken aback by kind of what she was capable of. There's a gentleman in North Carolina, Beto Herrera, who I was also like super talented. And so, you know, got exposed to it. And then I went back to campus after my internship and kind of set things down. So I may have gone out dancing once or twice, but in Tallahassee, a lot of the dancing at the time was in on Florida State's campus. And so there just weren't the same opportunities available to FAMU students. I'm glad to say that that has changed. Miriam Watkins is one of the leaders in the Tallahassee dance scene. Arguably the leader in the Tallahassee dance scene. She's actually from here in Memphis, but has lived in Tallahassee since graduating from FAMU. And she's definitely kind of broadened who the dance is exposed to in the city there. So shout out to Miriam. But at the time, it was like one or two or three places, and it was just like, I don't necessarily feel comfortable. And so was actually started my career in Northern Trust. And I knew I was going to Miami. My brother Corey was coming back from, or he knew he was coming back off a deployment at the time. And so he said, when I come back from
Okay.
deployment, I want to go to the Puerto Rico Salsa Congress, right? Which is the oldest, the most well-known, probably the most respected salsa congress out there. And I was
Okay.
like, that's great. I haven't danced in like 4 years, right? And so it's like, well, I got to figure this thing out and figure it out quickly because time is quickly approaching. And so at the office in Miami, I start asking around. I'm like, hey, who here dances salsa, right? And so as you might imagine, the office had a large Cuban population,
Right.
and the people in the office point me to the black guy from the U.S. Virgin Islands. And his name was Sean Osborne. Shout out to Sean. And of course, at the time, because I knew a little bit about what I was talking about, I said, hey, Sean, I hear you dance salsa. And I asked him the most important question for me, which is, do your instructors teach on one or on two? And he said, they
Right.
teach on two. And I was like, all right, that'll work for me, right? Because when I learned in Norfolk, I learned how to dance on two. And so I started taking classes with his teachers, Iggy and Yvette Merga of Addicted to Salsa. And, I was not ready for what I saw in Puerto Rico. I was not mentally prepared. I remember seeing a young Elvis Collado, and I was just like, at the time, he was probably, I don't know, 19 years old, something like that. And I was looking at this kid, I'm like, he's a better dancer right now than I'm ever going to be in my life. Like, I'm already packing it up. But it was also like I got to see kind of the breadth of what the dance could be. And
Okay.
in a very, very strong, obviously, Hispanic community, which was that context was helpful for me. So
So like that was
I
a very pivotal moment.
I mean, because there's some the cultural artifacts is something you don't necessarily get to see in a studio setting, right? And
Right.
so it was just really impactful in that way.
Okay.
So long story short, I finished my time in Miami. That was December 2011. Come back to or go back to Chicago. And after about, I go out dancing once, like in February. And then I, again, hadn't really started dancing consistently. And in September of that year, so September of 2011, no, 2012 is when I started like dancing with consistency. I just started going out. There's a point in time in my life where I was going out dancing five, six, 7 nights a week. I do not know how I did it. I'm glad that my work did not suffer too much for it.
Right.
But that's when I really got ingrained in the Chicago Latin dancing. I joined a team there, got the opportunity to travel and dance on the team. And then, me and my brother, now that we were both part of the same community, had the opportunity to travel together. He, could share contacts with me if I was going somewhere to make introductions. And that's how I kind of got ingrained in the community. And that's kind of how my path really started circa 2012.
Man, that's awesome. And so after 2012, that was when you started teaching. Was that, or was that much later?
Much later. So I started teaching in I think 2018, 2017, 2018. And it really
Okay.
was so kind of backing up a little bit. In 2016, my brother and I made a decision. The decision was made in 2015. We executed in 2016 that we wanted to do an event in Memphis. And the intention of that event was to expose people to some of the things that we were able to see outside of Memphis, right? So my brother's danced literally all over the world, myself all over the US, and taking trips to Canada and some other places. And so, we've seen a fair amount of things, and we wanted people to be exposed not just to the talent, but also the level of instruction that's available out there. So we decided to organize and successfully execute at Baila Memphis, which was a weekender. If I'm being honest, we did not know what we were doing, but we had some incredible people to support us here locally, just in terms of helping us to execute it. And then we also had some incredible artists that helped to take our vision and make it a reality. And we learned a lot of lessons. Some of those lessons are expensive, but the experience is probably the most important part. But, you know, that's kind of where things started. And I think ultimately I kind of made a decision like, hey, I want to be able to share some of the knowledge and experience that I've had as well. And so I made a decision, hey, I want to teach. And so what I first decided to do was, hey, I need some experience teaching. So I was able to work with Maritza Valentine at Latin Rhythms. She gave me my first opportunity to teach, specifically teaching bachata. And then because I am who I am, I said, I don't want to misinform people. I don't want to miseducate people. And I see, unfortunately, a lot of instructors do that. So I decided to kind of work on getting certified. I'd had a private lesson with Tomas Guerrero from Santo Rico. And Tomas was like, hey, I'm working on the certification program. And when he said it at the time that I took the private, it wasn't something that aligned with what I was trying to do. Moving forward, it was like, oh, this is perfect because this is somebody who's done it for 20 plus years. You know, obviously has name recognition and notoriety. And that's the thing I think most people would think about. I thought about it from the perspective of, you have a successful studio that you ran in New York for 20 years. And the number of people that I know that come off the Santo Rico tree, in terms of groups, but also in terms of individuals who may have started and learned their basic steps there, means that there was something in the process that was repeatable. And so learning about it from that perspective was helpful, right? It was not necessarily a message of like, this is the only way to do it. It was, this is a good way to do it, to give people a base. And that way that they can then go and take that base and kind of get information from other folks and like really that. Expand their knowledge. But,
because
we wanted to be able to at least give people that.
Oh, sorry, you kind of froze for a second. But yeah, I was going to say, like, I like that because I guess that way people get to diversify, you know, not misleading, like not walking away with like the raw knowledge, but just like having the base knowledge, but then diversifying, and then you get styles from that, right? Like, you're still frozen, I think. All right, so you mentioned before, I thought that was really interesting how you said, you mentioned this group and how they would, the people that would come out of that group, that studio, they would learn the bass, but then later on, I guess, diversify, you know, be a bit more creative and like have that freedom to do more, I guess I can say.
Yeah, I think I kind of look at it a little bit like martial arts, right? Like, so you have a sensei, right? And the sensei kind of teaches you everything that they can teach you. And then at a certain point in time, like, you have to find a new sensei, right? Or if you're Bruce Lee, like, you come up with your own martial arts, right?
Right.
And all those things are appropriate, right? I think in a more kind of focused way, what I mean is, I think there's several ways that people interpret the way we dance salsa on two. If we're being fair, all of that still is rooted in what Eddie Torres did, but it has been shaped and moved in a bunch of different directions. And so there's kind of what some people will call like Bronx style mambo, from people like Santo Rico or from like a Yamule or a Carisma. And so like that's kind of one vertical, but Eddie's still kind of home tree, if you will. And so you're going to get different messages from those groups. For me, it's, you got to figure out what works for you, what applies best to your body and the way you want to express yourself. But you still need some kind of a home base, whether it's kind of the Eddie style, whether it's, you know, Santo Rico, whether it's, if you're on the West Coast, folks like Alma Latina, everybody has their kind of methodology. You just need to start somewhere, and right. Then you'll learn from other teachers, and you'll figure out like, oh, I like that, but the way they explained it to me makes more sense to me, or I like that technique to execute this move better. But if you have no technique, it's kind of a wash. And so that's what I was going after,
Right.
In my kind of certification process.
Yeah, it's interesting. I like that. Different. I do think that's a good parallel, martial arts, learning the basics, but then you enter like a different style, you know, or the creation of a different style, you know, not because you want to mislead or because you want to change the tradition per se, but just, you know, being, what am I trying to say? I guess being different, you know?
Yeah. I mean, there's somebody like Frankie Martinez, who his style is, for many people, would be very eclectic. And his premise and how he teaches and why he teaches and what he teaches, again, still all in the same shape, if you will, right, in the same kind of sphere. But he is radically different than I think what you would get from Eddie Torres or Adolfo. Adolfo and Eddie Torres are much, much closer in terms of what they teach and how they teach because, again, of their proximity, and they have similar views of the world. So,
okay. And then I wanted to talk about something that was mentioned in the last episode with my father. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's from New York, and he was around that era, you know, late 60s and into the 70s, you know, the birth of Latin Boogaloo or Latin Soul, and even like the hustle and then salsa. And so I wanted to talk a bit more about Latin Boogaloo, or, you know, like what do you know about Latin Boogaloo? What have you learned about that genre?
Yeah, so I think the first thing I would say is I would want to take a step back, because I think we have to start with Latin music, what we call salsa now, but it was called other things beforehand,
right?
How we get to even to Latin Boogaloo, right? Because I think I come from a different understanding, right? What I mean by that is there is an ownership thing that happens within the Hispanic community, right? And so, like, Cubans would be like, salsa music is ours, and Puerto Ricans are like, salsa music is ours, and like, everybody wants to have, like, hold it really, really close. Right.
Right.
I think also there's still even just a communal thing of like, this is our thing, as far as like people in Central South America and certain parts of North America. Right.
Right.
What I would say is what most people talk about as far as salsa music in the U.S. and what our ears are attuned to, we have to be really clear about that. It does not happen without Black people. And I'm not just talking about Black, dark-skinned folks from Cuba and from Puerto Rico. Right. I mean, African-Americans, right?
Right. Because of, like, the jazz element that was involved early on in Latin music in New York, like, jazz was, that jazz element is very, very important in that
area. Absolutely. And, like, structurally, like, so if we think about it, like, again, we have to give respect and onus to ancestors, so it comes from Cuba to us, right? A bunch of different forms in terms of cha-cha-cha, soul music, mambo, like all these different movements that happen, right? And again, because most of our traditions are storytelling traditions, it's important that we include the right characters as well, right?
Right.
And so this is not a shot across the bow at the many of the folks like, and God bless, you know, bless the day in terms of Johnny Pacheco. But if we're being clear, Arsenio Rodriguez is a very, very big component in terms of creating the rhythmic structures that undergird a lot of what we call salsa music today, right? And this is a blind trace player from Cuba, from the descendants of Congolese slaves. And a lot of that was embedded in the music that he created, right? But he provided a lot of the architecture, if you will, upon which the music, the melody kind of sits on top of, right? Mm-hmm. If we talk about kind of Afro-Latin, or at the time, Afro-Cuban music and Afro-Cuban jazz, that is a conversation happening between folks like Chano Paso and Mario Bauza and Dizzy Gillespie. And like literally saying, I'm going to take these jazz riffs and melodies and place it on top of these Caribbean rhythmic patterns, right? So Mario Bausa and Chano are bringing their piece. Dizzy's bringing his piece. That's how we create Afro-Cuban music, which what we call salsa is now a derivative of, right? I'm not saying that there aren't other players in it, that they don't have important, strong importance to it, but this is how it starts. And so I say that because in that ownership piece, we don't have the music in the way that it sounds if you don't have Black, and by Black, I mean African-American jazz right. musicians talking to their immigrant counterparts, right?
Right.
Now, of course, then we have political context of, well, Cubans, you functionally can't be here anymore because we have an embargo because we have conflict with Cuba. So that mantle gets taken up largely by Puerto Ricans, right? And so right. you get the influx of things that are more traditionally Puerto Rican, like yeah. Momba, Yelena, right. different kind of versions, perhaps, of, say, son, right? Yeah. And so,
then you have people,
very
you,
important.
People, yeah, yeah. people so like... Is, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Go ahead.
I was say people like Hector Lavoe and Ismael Miranda, like a lot of like Puerto Ricans, like you see in Fania, Fania yes, Records.
Absolutely.
Like a lot of them are Puerto Rican and they use, yeah. you know, apply the Puerto Rican sounds.
And again, everybody's doing it, right? So if right. there's a Venezuelan who's creating music, they're going to bring the things from Venezuela, right? If I am right. Colombian, I'm bringing it, right? To be clear, there's some Cuban artists who migrated to Mexico and started making music to suggest that like Mexicans didn't have some influence in the music to some extent is also farcical, right? But like it's all of those things coming together that create the sounds that we call salsa music now, right? And so when people try to, you know, do the, hey, so again, I happen to be fair skinned. It is what it is. That's just how I'm made up, right?
Right.
So when people see that I dance well and their natural impetus is, what are you? Who are you?
Yeah, they ask that question like, from? Hey, are you Dominican? Are you Cuban? Guano, Dominicano? Like they ask those kind of questions to you because, you know, of how you look.
That is suggestive of the ownership piece, right?
Right.
And again, I even though it is not quote unquote my music, I didn't grow up with it culturally and I'm not from New York. As a Black American, this is also part of our catalog, right? And so like, yes, Black Americans have a place in it too. And we've always been there, right? And so like, so it's also important just kind of contextualize this of many of the kind of greatest composers that we talk about in Afro-Cuban music or salsa music, right? The Eddie and Charlie Palmieri,
Tito Puente, right?
They're known as not just salsa artists, but also Latin jazz artists, right? Well, these are working artists in the 1950s and 60s, right? So they are playing jazz. Who are they playing jazz with, right? If you take a look at the Palladium nightclub, right, which is like the piece that is astonishing in the movement, it sits in Midtown Manhattan, is surrounded by 40 jazz clubs, right? So this context of like, it was not strange. There are even stories that are told about Herbie Hancock and sitting in for a set at the Palladium, right? So there's this constant back and forth. It's the music is broader than just the narrow view that we may impress upon it because we just don't know. And that's why right. I'm a big component of educating myself, but also educating others, right? I could say the same thing about jazz, which is jazz has a heavy influence. And again, I only noticed because of, you know, my good friend, Antonio Quinn has a super strong influence in terms of Jewish composers and artists, right? If we try to tell the story of jazz and then include Jewish people, we're being disingenuous, right? And so that's why I think we have to start with that base, right? Now, when we get to Latin Boogaloo, now we have the context of it's a literal conversation. It is, hey, I like that cha-cha thing you're doing. I need you to put some funk on it because it don't speak to me as a right. Black guy in Harlem, right?
Right.
Or I'm a Puerto Rican and I'm in Harlem. And yes, I'm having all these other influences in my life. And I want to bring that into quote unquote my music, right? Right? Or if we look at kind of who some might argue is the king of Latin Boogaloo, right? In terms of Joe Bataan,
yeah, you Joe have Bataan.
A African American and Filipino guy who's the head of a right. Puerto Rican street gang who sings doo-wop songs on the corner. It is again, it is all of the things that allow us to create this Latin boogaloo sound, right? Like he is like literally the face of, this is how you put it all together to come up with Latin boogaloo, right? And so it's not strange for us to have all of those things melting, compounding upon each other to create a new sound, right? And a sound that everybody can find their part to, right? Like for those people who are more influenced by the traditional sounds, quote unquote, that cha-cha rhythm in the background, all that speaks to me, right? For that person who has more of an R&B ear, that doo-wop, that funk, that speaks to me, right? If I'm living in both worlds where I speak Spanish to my parents and English to my friends, now I got quote unquote Spanish music with English lyrics, it speaks to me, right? And so it's all of the things, and that's why I think it became so successful, right? The then question becomes, why did it die out? Let's be clear, it didn't die out, it was killed. Who killed it, and why did they kill it, right? I'll leave that to people to do their own research. What I would say, however, is I think Latin Boogaloo could have been far more powerful from a societal perspective than it was allowed to be.
Yes, I think about that. I think about that all the time, you know, like I was like, wow, like this is like, what if it lived on into the 70s and 80s and 90s and 2000? Like, imagine what we would have, you know, just it'd be cool, you know, but that's not, you know, that's not how it turned out.
Yeah. And like, again, there were some things that were happening from a social and political perspective. Right. We had a movement where I think a lot of folks were trying to figure out their identity in New York. And so there were some benefits to creating the genre. And again, I mean, literally creating the genre of salsa and then using that to perpetuate a certain type of communal pride. Right.
Right.
What I would also say is if you were to go back historically and talk about some of the people I mentioned beforehand, especially those Cuban artists that came over to the U.S., it's not coincidental that those dark-skinned Cuban artists decided to take up station in Harlem and that they saw themselves as not separate and apart, but a part of a larger Black community and a connectedness, right? And so I think we have to ask some important questions around what does it mean in terms of, from an identity perspective, to be Hispanic or Latino? And how does that juxtapose? How does that perhaps conflict with someone saying, I have an identity of being Black, right? I think we're wrestling with that, right? But like my observation is, from the outside looking in, is if I were to go to pretty much any nation in the Western Hemisphere, here's the thing I know. If I want to find the people who are impoverished, I can look for skin tone. That's going to give me a pretty good indication, right? So the concept that we don't deal with racism in the New World, we only deal with it in Canada, in the US, well, we're the only people who are dealing with it who have been oppressed continuously. But for people who decide to immigrate here, you get checked out of the oppression that you lived at in your home country. You just checked into a different type of oppression, right? And so it feels different and you engage it differently. But it does mean like there's a power, or there was a potential power in saying, we want to create a broader community and identity. And it also means that there's a, there are things within the Hispanic community that, like, again, I'm not a part of it, but I think it's important questions that we have to ask, right? So what does the things like the phrase mejorar la raza, what does that mean?
Yeah.
Right. What does that mean today?
Yeah. Improve the race. Yeah. Or fix the race.
Right. Right. Yeah. Like, again, there's a undertone there. Right. And so are we fighting the same battle? Or are we fighting different battles? Right. Are you, and if we're fighting the same battle, how do you identify that clearly? And if we're not fighting the same battle, then you're really an ally. I treat allies perhaps a little bit different than I treat those people who feel I'm in community with, right? And so that's part of the conversation that has to happen on some level, right? Hmm. So yeah,
really cool stuff, you know, like there's a lot more to Like there were times when I would listen to like stuff like salsa music, for example, and people have like this foreign like connotation to it. And just like, well, if you learn the history, like there's a lot more, it's not as foreign, it isn't as foreign as you think, you know? It's a lot more close to home.
You know, it was again largely produced in New York and Puerto Rico, right? As far as the sounds that we typically, the records that typically get spun and played, but even stuff that's produced in Puerto Rico, and again to a smaller extent in Miami, like heavily influenced by the sound that's coming out of New York, right? It is that it's created there and then it propagates in other places. And again, I think we just have to learn how to. For me, it's like I need to learn how to speak and listen to Spanish fluently so I can really understand what's happening as opposed to having to Google the lyrics, right? But I think it's also important, like, you know, there's some songs that have like a very historical context, like Joe Arroyo Rebelia, right? But there are other songs like, no, these people are writing about their circumstance today, and they mean it as of today. So we need to understand point of reference and time, what's happening in that context. So they're just speaking about, hey, this is how I'm living through my current condition, right? And I think, you know, understanding the context of the song from the songwriter's perspective gives us a lot more impact in terms of how we're supposed to take it and use it, right? And like also realize like it's so layered and it's so many levels to it, right? So there can be something as simple as double entendre, right? There's also you know, this context of like perhaps there are spiritual and religious overtones to what's happening in the song, right?
Yeah,
It's
your
something we don't talk about
songs.
at
Yeah,
all.
right.
And it's like, no, they're saying something very specific and they mean it in a very spiritual way. And so your decision, perhaps, to dance in a way that is reflective of that spiritual thing, as I say it, like you're calling on something and you might be surprised when it answers back, right? And so you should know that so you know how far down that road you want to go, because you might not be prepared for that answer when it comes to you. So.
Yeah, you're talking about the Orishas, like Imaya, Butala. Like you hear those in songs pretty often in salsa music.
Absolutely. And again, there's a lot of conversation around like these concepts of cultural appropriation that are happening in the salsa scene, right? And I think that conversation isn't just about, it's about a number of things, right? But it's not just about like what are people from outside of the community, quote unquote, doing. It is also if I am taking somebody's spiritual belief system and the dance is connected to that, and I am putting that on as costume in the way that I dance and perform, that is appropriative. It doesn't matter if I'm part of the community or not, right? Because for me, it's just something cool to do. For them, this is about a spiritual experience. You should know about that and make a thoughtful decision. I think sometimes we're not, we don't take the time to walk down the path and say, I've made a thoughtful decision, a conscious decision, and I feel comfortable with it. It's just like, oh, I can do that move because it looks cool. All right. Again, I don't have to have that specific spiritual belief to realize that I do believe in our ability to call on spirits, gods perhaps. When it answers back, then you'll have your answer.
Yeah, man. And let's see. Let's talk about oh, you know what? Yeah, perfect segue. Why should people learn how to dance?
Great question. So I'll say two things.
And I guess not learn the Arisha style, you know.
So to be fair, I'm not saying don't learn. I'm saying actually be intentional in learning,
Right, yeah,
right?
irrespective, be intentional, yeah.
Be intentional and be
Gotcha.
respectful is the ultimate
Right.
thing, right? Everything else is again left up to personal discretion, right? I think there are a number of different reasons to learn how to dance. I think at a super high level, you know, for me, it's about it's a metaphor for a relationship, right? And so I'm having a conversation with my partner. We're not using our words, but like I am giving something as the lead to try to suggest something for my partner. They're going to give me input that either accepts it or rejects it. I'm going to take that information and then we'll continue this back and forth dialogue, right? Yeah, notice I said, I didn't say I'm going to lead my partner. I'm going to give my partner a suggestion.
Right.
They're going to either accept it or reject it. They have the option to take it or to not take it, right? Or to take it and adapt it in a way that maybe I didn't think about, right? And so there's this constant back and forth. You know, there are times where it is, hey, I want to break around away from my partner because I have something very specific I want to say, and I want to say it my way, and you're not going to influence that. And my partner also has that opportunity to do the same thing, right? And so I think you can tell a lot about people by dance, right? And by how they approach dance. And like, I can tell, you know, we danced with people long enough, you can tell when they're having a pretty bad day.
Sorry, is that me? Is that me or is that you?
It's not me.
Let me turn that. Yeah, sorry about that.
No worries. So yeah, I can tell a lot about somebody in terms of how their day is going, about how they view the world, especially if I've danced with them a number of different times. You can just pick up on a lot of things in people's energy. Mm. And so like that's like the like, you know, philosophical reason why people should dance, right? I think the other reason is the exposure to the Latin dance community in particular. It is, I want to be clear about this, it is imperfect. It needs a lot of growth and development. But the opportunities I've had to connect with people in and up and down and left and right of any spectrum you can think about, it has, for me, opened my viewpoint, my vantage point. It's allowed me to really think and wrestle with some of my own things in order to be able to actually become a better person and more the person I want to be. And it has allowed me to just meet a ton of different people and pre-pandemic have the opportunity to travel a number of different places and connect with people who I may only connect with once and have this really great formative experience and then kind of go about my day, right? I think the other piece of it is we also have to tell the truth. Dancing is one of the most intimate things that you can do, right? And I don't mean it like in some like sappy kind of way. I mean it like, when's the last time you walked up to a stranger and held hands for 4 minutes?
Right.
Most people don't do that, right? So it is by its very nature, you're in somebody's space and in somebody's bubble, right? And yet it's also not intimate, right? Like there is not a necessary intonation of, I want something from you in a physically intimate way or vice versa, right?
Right.
And so it operates in this space that allows, if it's done well and done right, people to grow in ways they just don't appreciate, right? And then there's all of the, you know, like the things that you put on a checklist, like, yeah, you get opportunity to exercise, you get opportunity to meet people, you got a place to go out, like all that stuff is cool right. too, right? But I think those other pieces to me are like why people should dance and why people continue to dance. And like, there's a, you know, it's kind of a bell curve, if you will, as far as dancers. And usually about 2 to 3 years, like most of people are out of dance, right? And that's because they've gotten from it what they wanted from it, right? Or unfortunately, sometimes they've had a really nasty experience. And that's, again, something that the dance community as a whole has to work on, right? For the people who kind of are in that 5 year, 7 year, 10 year and beyond, dance usually takes like, on a different identity.
Yeah, it means something more to them, you know, because I met guys, you know, in the social dance scene where just like, oh, I'm just here because of the girls, you know, and then they have the same mindset the whole time, you know, but the person that's there for the long run and enjoys multiple things about it, multiple aspects, that means like, dancing means something more for them, and you can see that.
Yeah, I'll also say
that's the case for me too. Again,
I'm going to say this because, again, other people are afraid to say it. Let's be clear. There are guys who have been here for a decade or more who are still about getting women, like, or men or whatever right. their predilection is, right?
Right.
Those people, like, it just means there's something else as well. But, like, right. those guys are still there, right? Like, right. just because yeah. he's been, like, for anybody who's looking to date somebody based on how long they've been in the dance scene, that's also a bad measure.
Right, yeah. Right?
but I think what you bring out is like a really important point, right? Which is Frankie Martinez said it in a different way. And it's like, to give this illustration of like, you see like this 80-year-old couple dancing, right? And like, they're not doing the same things they were doing when they were in their 20s and their 30s. And they don't have like, and so like all of the ego piece of the dance has left them with their physical abilities. And so their dance is a different dance. And when you see that couple dance, even though it's not the coolest dance, you're looking for that thing, right? Mm. And so I think for a lot of dancers, we go into the space and, you know, it really is about that next best dance. It is an addictive thing. Like, it literally is like that search for how do I get that next high and that next amazing dance, right?
Yeah, I'm guilty. Yeah. There's a,
like, again, we're all guilty yeah. of it, right?
Right.
I think there's a point where it's like, you realize, like, there is no next better dance, right? And it's at that point where you have to reevaluate what your relationship is like with dance. And I think that's when you see kind of people start to express themselves differently in terms of the way that they perform. People start to kind of seek out different dance adventures because it's not about dance as the physical artifact or the expression. It's about dance as the idea. And so I'm hopeful that one day if I stick around long enough, I'll get to that place. And I won't necessarily, as Frankie said, have to be 60, 70, 80 years old to get there.
Yeah, man, it's really, really cool stuff. Dancing is really, really like a, like I myself encourage other people to dance also. I mean, it might be different now. It is different now because of COVID, but it's a very fun activity. And
oh, yeah. Just mask up.
Yeah.
In COVID times, you just got to mask up.
Right. Like I say, for me, it's done a whole lot, you know, as far as personality, as far as how I feel about myself and like how I, you know, I got more comfortable in my own skin and, you know, different things, many things. And I see myself doing this for a long time, dancing for a long time, especially when it comes to salsa music. You know, I'm a bit biased. I like bachata a little bit, but like salsa, that's my, you know, that's my shit, you know, that's my stuff. But yeah, it's very,
fun. I think it's great to have a preference. You know, I'm a little bit more of a like, and I'm like this in life. It's like, what do I want at that given time? Mm-hmm. It's not necessarily like a choice of either, or it's like, what's the flavor for today? Or what do I want to dance to for this song? And, you know, I'll say a brief message about bachata. I think it is highly misunderstood and underappreciated. And so like, again, to the, in the same way that people who dance salsa in a studio setting, at least, are addicted to a lot of turn patterns and spins and tricks if it's performances. Yeah. I think people who dance bachata are similarly inundated with a bunch of images of what has been deemed sensual, right? As far as, you know, body rolls and all those things, right? And again, like, mm-hmm. This is not a knock towards anybody in any specific style. What I would say is to that last point about like figuring out what your relationship is with dance, it also means figuring out what your relationship is with music, right? And there's some things that are going on in songs that are produced from the DR that I think are just underappreciated. And also, you know, I'm a big on like, I'm a Virgo, so I'm very specific with my language, and I speak with a lot of clarity and concreteness. And so, you know, there are questions around if a musical genre has a core set of principles, inclusive of instruments, structure, what have you. If I don't have those ingredients together, am I making the same recipe, right? And most of us just, you know, we're just kind of going through the paces, and it's like, this thing sounds similar enough to this thing, it is what it is, right? I'm a little bit more direct and like, well, if I only got three out of the five ingredients, and you know, the structure isn't the same, but it's not the same thing, right? So we have a lot of different options around that. We could call something different. We could add an adjective, all those things. But like, my example kind of would be like, we all kind of know the basic format for a hamburger, right? It is, ground beef, probably some type of a bun, lettuce, tomato. Like, this is, pre-consensus driven. Right. Pickles, some type of condiments. Yeah. It is what it is, right?
Maybe cheese,
pepper. Plenty of time, like if I'm using sliced bread and it's not ground beef, is it a burger? I don't know. What if it's only got one slice and doesn't have both slices, right? I mean, I guess you can make an argument it's an open-faced burger. It is a sandwich. Burger is left up for interpretation, right? And so that's kind of one side of it. I think the other part of it is like the stories that are being told. For those people who have an affinity for blues music, especially, I think if you look at not just the music itself and the content of it, because I think that tracks very well if you look at blues and how it becomes rhythm and blues, but also the story of where it comes from, who it comes from, how it gains acceptance. Again, if I just told you, hey, there's a music genre that comes from people in the country and the people in the city don't accept it, but the people in the country have a bunch of parties around it, and then they bring it to the city and they still don't accept it until some people say it's cool, and then everybody else says, well, I guess it's cool. I could be talking about bachata or blues, right? Like, a bachata being not just a musical genre, but a certain kind of a party in the campesino, in the, what do we call it? In the countryside, right? Kind of sounds like a jig joint in Mississippi to me, right? And so having that context of like, and I believe this and I affirm this, like, especially those folks in the Caribbean who are of African descent, like, those are my cousins. You may not recognize me as your cousin, but we are just like, again, y'all have a little bit different mix because it was Spaniards and some French people involved, right? But like, y'all got dropped off maybe a little bit earlier or a little bit later than my folks did, likely in South Carolina.
Right, different boat stop.
But like, but we're still related, right? Mm-hmm. And so because of that, we have to recognize, and I think what you saw at the early part of Afro-Cuban music is a very strong recognition of like, I understand that we see the world in the same way, that we're experiencing the same things. I think over time, that thing has dissipated. I would like us to be able to bring the thing in a little bit tighter so we can kind of recognize that.
That's beautiful, man. And then, let's talk about African-Americans and salsa. I mean, we've been talking about it the whole time, but I guess going on that train still, you mentioned to me, that you want to talk about African Americans and how they currently operate in the salsa scene, well, the current social dancing scene.
Yeah.
As far as like structures and congresses and things like that.
Yeah. So I think in this moment in time, there's a super big focus on African and African related things, right?
Right. Afrobeat. Yeah.
But also, I mean, like just in particular, the context of dealing with racial issues in the U.S. as a function of the death of George Floyd. And what does that mean for everybody? But, it's making its way into the salsa scene. Right. It's to be clear, there have been Black artists in what we call the salsa scene since the beginning. Right. So people give a lot of respect. And again, like, Eddie Torres is the GOAT. Eddie Torres is the GOAT. Eddie Torres is the GOAT. I said it three times, therefore it is, right? you can watch a lot of videos of Eddie Torres, and there's this dark-skinned man right beside him, Dalil Thomas, right? Dalil deserves his flowers as well, right? There have been artists, and again, not just Black artists in the U.S., but also abroad, people like Chaka Brown, people like Leon Rose, Sekou continues to be a name out there, and several other artists who have been able to build very successful careers who never quite got the same recognition as some of their counterparts, who I think are equally, if not more talented, right? And so we have to wrestle with why those people didn't necessarily get the shots, right? Some of those people didn't get the shots because they challenged the system. Somebody like a Gordon Neal, like, again, Gordon is a phenomenal dancer, right? Like, people should study him just to understand, like, what the spirit is he puts into how he constructs performances and how he socially dances, right?
Oh, have you seen, like, Terry? I don't know his last name, but Terry? Terry. Afro from France?
Yeah, yeah. And again, like, Terry's part of that tree, right?
Right, yeah.
But, like, I might argue Terry could be bigger than he is. I might make that argument, right? I would also say implicitly, like, there are a lot of talented Black female artists who also have not gotten the shine that they deserve, right? So I mentioned Leah Patterson. You know, I could talk about Stacey Pond. I could talk about Carmen Ginn from the St. Louis Salsa Congress. I can go down a long list, right? You know, Candace Jordan from, you know, Fuego y Hielo. Like, you know, Jante Thibodeau and Tiffany Mensah. Like, they're people we've been putting in this work, right? And so my apprehension is that we're going to see a strong proliferation over the next year or two of African-based choreographies. And here's what I'm going to guess, because most of the teams ain't got no Black folks on them, won't be no Black folks in those routines, right? Which is an interesting commentary of, I'm going to take the idea and get benefit from it, but not put people in place to execute the idea, or maybe better than that, partner with people who are capable of doing that work, because I want to elevate them, because I actually understand with diversity, equity, and inclusion, most important of those being the equity piece, right? And so those are things that we have to wrestle with as a community. I don't know what the answers are, right? Like, I'm just here to say, this is what I'm waiting on, and I'll be shocked if I see something different, right? And it also means, like, we have to understand how, I don't like using the word privilege, but how access works, right? So if I have two artists who are comparable, one of them is a little bit darker skin, they're probably taking the lighter skin artist, right? If they're both kind of the same color, but one of them is quote unquote regular Black, they're African-American, but the other one of them has a story about behind them. They're from Africa. They're from, you know, Dominica. Like, I'm from the island. Like, okay, I can take that. I can run with that. Right. I'm from Martinique. Oh, we can run with that. Right. And so, like, there are layers to this access thing, right? If we don't have the same shape, right? I myself, as a bigger guy, I'm always going to have a challenge, whether it's getting a social dance, whether it's actually getting on stage to perform, whether it's teaching. Again, this isn't my profession, right? I don't do this for a living, but I know it's a hardship. If I wanted to do it for a living, I would have to deal with, right? And so we have to have those conversations and wrestle with those things, because if you are on one side saying, hey, I'm supportive of Black Lives Matter, I believe in that, but you're doing choreography, performances, managing a team, and they're Black dancers in your community, and you're not seeking those people out, and you're not trying to give those people a platform, who are you really? I don't know. Yeah. You're giving me mixed messages, right? And it also means, and again, like, it goes without saying, but I'll say it because people, for whatever reason, we don't want to say this. All this music is African. It's all based off of Africa. So, like, this idea of I'm gonna check in and out of Africa, again, even if you are, and again, even if you happen to be more fair-skinned, even if you can trace your lineage back to Italians and Spaniards and Portuguese people, like, again, you have to understand the base that you're working off of, And so it is not just counterintuitive, it is deception to say, I love this African music and I'm not going to help African people,
right?
Whether it's in my home country or it's in the United States.
Right. Yeah, that's happened like, over and over again.
I say that. Yeah, like, and I say it explicitly because that's how I'm counting. That's how I'm charging people. Like, if you say you're about this thing, but you only want to use it for your own grandeur, but you don't want to help the people, or more accurately, the progeny of the people who created it, of the people who died for it. Like, this is music based off of oppression. And you don't want to help the same people who are still being oppressed today. Yes, I have a problem with it. Yes, I'm going to call you.
And you know what? Like, I want to talk about this. Like, it made me think about this. Might be more of a silly thought, but, you know, as far as like foxtrot, swing, Lindy Hop, things like that, those are things that aren't really a part of like African-American culture anymore. But there are, you know, part of our history. I guess like for a while, like you see like white dancers dancing those dances. Swing, foxtrot, etc. Also, like, do you think like Latin dance can kind of, I guess, bring African Americans back to that plate, like using, like having partner dancing, I guess, social dancing being part of our culture again? Yeah, if that makes sense.
Yeah. So again, I think it could be, but also like I want to be clear, like it's not that it's not, right? I think there are pockets where it is still very much a part of the structure, right? So if you talk about
North Carolina,
Chicago.
I was gonna say North Carolina, you still have people dance shag. There's still people that remember shag and dance a little bit of shag. So it's still, still kind of there.
Well, you got shag there. You got Zydeco in New Orleans. You have like people who dance the actual hustle in New York. You have Detroit version of stepping, right? So like there's. The answer is not all or none. It is like, we've lost some of it. Some of that is just based on how our community has dispersed, right? Which is a whole separate conversation for a very different podcast, right? but like, I think to your point, like, is there a way to, can Latin dance be one way to get that music and dance aspect, right, engaged? Yeah. I think it absolutely can, right? I also think like there are other ways that many Black folks have gotten that access to that thing, right? So for many Black folks, it wasn't partner dance, but like the influence of the music as well as the dance of the church filled that void for them, right? That spiritual release, right? And like even the ability to like just physically shout and stomp your feet and all those things, right? And dance around the church. And again, I'm not suggesting that those people were not in the spirit. So for all the spiritual people, the religious people, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that like that still is a certain type of release that is another venue for what you're talking about, right? And so I think there are a number of ways that we can get to that.
Right.
I do think though, maybe a different point is the importance or the potential importance of partner dance and what it means for how people understand relationships is something that could be additive to our community.
Well said. Well said. And also I want to talk about why is it important to learn from other cultures?
So
a follow-up with that would be, does Memphis need more diversity?
Yeah. So I think it is important in terms of having that context and frame of reference, because it changes how you operate in the world, right? And I'll give a very quick story. So 2004, my brother got married actually on my birthday, so I'll never forget, and gets married in Naples, Italy. And at that time, the only place I traveled outside of the United States is Canada. And so I'm in Naples, Italy for more or less 48 hours because of my educational commitments. And I just remember something as simple as going into the grocery store to buy a bottle of Coca-Cola at the local sundry shop next to the hotel. And like I have euros, which I've never seen in my life, even, but the numbers are printed, so that makes my life a little bit easier. And the, cashier doesn't know whether I speak Italian or not. And so they're just like, this is the price, right? Because this, you're Italy, you probably speak Italian, right? And they speak no English, right? So I'm like, I don't know what this is. And so then we have to do the let's do mind games to figure out how much this actually costs. And oh, I need that coin, not that coin, right? And you find out how even in when you leave yourself of all your devices, you can communicate, right? But also gain like a huge respect for like a different type of communal feeling. Like at the time it was the case that most Italians lived at home until they got married. Marriage was like kind of the signal that we go off and do our own thing. Being able to, see a place where like literally everybody goes on vacation in August, right? Like the entire country just off for 3 weeks, right? And so they have a different frame of reference for work. Even just being on the streets of a city where it's like there are two defined lanes of traffic and there are three cars across. There's something that is not working here. My American mind doesn't get it. They figured out how to drive in very interesting circumstances, right? So like all the things I take for granted because it's just my lived experience, like they're living a completely different experience there. And I have to get wrap my mind around like, oh, just because this is the way I do it or the way I've seen it done doesn't mean that's the way it has to be done. And there are arguably an infinite number of possibilities. So it really does open up your mind frame, right? To this question about diversity in Memphis, right? I would say two things, or I say one thing. I don't know if Memphis needs more diversity. I do know that Memphis needs more equity and more inclusion, right? So, in a city that is more than 50% Black, our school system is something on order of 75 to 80% Black, and our county is about 50-50, maybe 45-55, either way. Right? It's not an issue, perhaps, as far as like we don't have enough minorities, right? We also have a very significant Vietnamese and Cambodian population. We have one of the fastest growing Hispanic populations in the city of Memphis, as far as just the rate of growth. So, like, we're gonna get there, right? I think the bigger issue is perhaps who is getting a share of the pie, right? And I would say a distinction of how Memphis operates versus some of our other southern peers that are cities that would have been probably about the size of Memphis maybe 30 to 40 years ago is that Memphis operates in a way that says we are going to lock out people of color, but especially Black people from economic prosperity, right? If you look at our competitors as far as peer cities, what they have said is we will allow Black people to make money. We're just going to make way more money, right? But we're not going to cut off our nose to spite our face, right? Great example of that is even in the passing through of the Tennessee Oilers, which eventually became the Tennessee Titans, the NFL has a requirement in terms of minority ownership, even at that time, which is probably 20 years ago, right? So, to be clear, at the time, the Memphis Oilers or the Tennessee Oilers didn't have enough minority ownership. And the person who eventually owned that minority stake, it is been suggested that money was loaned to that person just so that we could justify having the team for the year or two that they were in Memphis, right? So you think about the fact that like we didn't have anybody, right, that could have filled that role, right? And it's pretty consistent, right? And so when we talk about educational outcomes, we talk about health outcomes. All of this usually generates from somebody's socioeconomic status. And so, until we're honest about dealing with and rectifying those differentials in socioeconomic status, for again, most of the city of Memphis, and that's the thing like we have to repeat to ourselves again, most of Memphis is Black. So, when we don't do things for Black people, we're literally saying we don't want to do things for Memphis.
Exactly.
That's strange, right?
Yeah, then look at
We
word of
have to
mouth.
figure that out.
And then look at Orange Mountain. Orange Mountain is like not what it like. It was. I need to do more research on this, but Orange Mountain was apparently like a powerhouse, almost how like Harlem was back in the day in New York, a big cultural hub and a place where Black people were trying to succeed, and then it became, you know, now it's known as the hood, you know.
So, just for point of reference, Orange Mound was actually originally a plantation.
Right.
Yeah. It was owned by a family. I cannot recall the name of the family at this juncture in time, but it was sold to a developer, got out of the Northeast. And basically, this is after the patriarch died. And the matriarch's one request was essentially don't sell this land to Black people. So that developer sold that land to Black people, and it is the first community in the United States that was actually built by and for Black people. So Black people create, like, literally built the houses that other Black people lived in, right? And so there's an economic power to that, right? And it was, you know, certainly between Orange Mound and Harlem kind of played that reference point as far as being a center of the Black community at a given time, or largest population of concentration of Black people, I think, outside of Harlem by the 70s, right? But it was tit for tat, right? And so there's a context to that. And that's why a lot of the residents of Orange Mound, especially the older residents, are extremely proud of being from Orange Mound, right? Because they know and understand that history. What I kind of come back to is all these things fit together, right? And so if you look at our biggest industry right now, right, which is transportation and logistics, as a general function, in order to be successful in transportation and logistics, you have to have a low labor force rate, right? And so you don't pay a lot of people money to move boxes, even if it's on a forklift, right? That's just how you stay competitive in the space, right? So when you drive off the Shelby County Airport property, the first sign you see is, hey, you know, America's Distribution Center. Some people would say, like, that's a great mark. And again, for us to have number one or number two cargo airport in the world is great. We also must know what that means is we have also marketed ourselves as we are a home for low-cost labor, right? Well, in order for you to have low-cost labor, a bunch of things have to happen. But one of the things that has to happen is you have to have a bunch of labor, a pool of labor that has no other options. And so we have to beg the question of, if we have underperforming schools in a city who requires low-cost labor, is it the chicken or is it the egg? I might argue it is our need for low-cost labor that drives our underperforming schools, not vice versa, because we could fix it if we wanted to, right? It also means, and again, this is going to ruffle some people's feathers, and if I'm being honest, I hope it does. It means that when people make a decision, a choice, desire to say, hey, we think the kids in Memphis deserve the same education as the kids that live in Shelby County broadly, and the people in the other cities in Shelby County say, no, we don't believe you deserve that. That's a very telling circumstance, right? They say, hey, we're going to check out. We're going to do our own thing because we don't even care about those kids in Memphis. That's what the annexation, or not the annexation, that's what the giving up of the charter of the city of Memphis schools or Memphis City schools and combination of Shelby County schools and also exit and creation of special districts. Oh, yes, but wait. Before those special districts could be created, they were actually unconstitutional. So somebody had to go to the state legislature in Tennessee. So they ran to Nashville in order to create a set of circumstances to be able to create these special school districts. So let's be clear. You were so upset. You so much didn't want those kids in Memphis to have the same education as your kids that you said, you know what? I don't even care what our collective governments have said. I'm going to go to a higher authority because that's how bad I don't want your kids to get an education. Now, we can run it back historically and we'll say, like, oh, that's not what I meant, or I didn't know that was a consequence. There was no other consequence. That was the only possible result, that those kids would get a separate and probably unequal education. Where have I heard that before? So again, we have to, if we're going to operate as a community, if we want to lift Memphis collectively, we really got to talk about what equity and inclusion means and what it means for the folks with the least amount of access, the least amount of opportunity, because that's how you drive better outcomes for the city of Memphis. And that's what I would be hopeful for in some future state.
All right. And then I have two more questions for you, like two last questions. The first one is, how has COVID-19 affected you?
Absolutely. So kind of like I echoed at the beginning of the episode, it's really given me a lot of chance, a lot of time to think and to really kind of reflect and figure out what path I want to take my my career, my life in. And so it helped me to make some decisions that I, that time and space to sit down helped me make some decisions, right? And to be clear, like I have not danced since March of 2020. And again, for me, as far as teaching and as far as hosting events, that was definitely the right decision. It was too risky for me. And also I didn't want to be a place where I create a compromise for anybody in the community. I just didn't think that was the right thing to do. Also, because I don't make my money from the profession, I thought even me teaching classes online would take away space that needed to be dedicated from this is how people eat, right? But it did help me also to kind of say, like, what do I want to do professionally, career-wise? I got a lot more clarity on that. And so that's been helpful. I've been, you know, one part of my family, we've had a Zoom call for literally 12 months now. You know, we'll be doing a little anniversary celebration in the next couple of Saturdays. And so it's helped me to kind of connect with that part of my family in a very, very meaningful way. And we've had, I've learned more about my family in the last year than I did maybe the previous 34, right? Just because I'm of age now, we're all of age, the people on the call, and it's just been a real exchange. And it's also, you know, it's come with some decisions in order to kind of get to where I desire to be. And so part of that was, you know, the intention was obviously just temporarily kind of shut down, say the Latin dance. Temporary has become permanent now. And that was just more a function of like some other things going on in my life professionally. And so, as I told you, I took on a new role. And so I made the decision in taking on that role, it requires me to leave Memphis. So I'm actually in the process of leaving Memphis. Will actually be transitioning to Charlotte in the next few months. And so
NC was North Carolina.
Yeah. Charlotte, North Carolina. Okay. And so it was, I do not think that set of circumstances happens one without the pandemic in particular. And then if I'm being very honest and very transparent, unfortunately the murder of George Floyd, set about a kind of course of reflection that helped me to say, like, you got to start getting into some of this business, what I might argue are my callings in life, and you need to stop being passive about that. You need to be very forthright and very forceful in pursuing the things that prepare you to take on those callings.
Mm. Yeah, I wish you luck in all that, man.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
But I am going to miss you. Miss seeing you dance, you know.
Well, at some point in time, you know, we will return to something different that will then be normal. Hopefully we'll have some videos we can share. More importantly, though, you know, Memphis is home. It's always going to be home. And so I'll certainly be back and forth, and hopefully I get the opportunity to connect with folks like yourself, but also some of our students and some of the other people who are part of the dance community in Memphis. It has not been easy. There have definitely been some roadblocks and hiccups, But I definitely learned a lot from that experience. And my only kind of wish is I could have done more and done better for the dance community in Memphis. And it's just, you know, you take that lesson and you take it on to the next thing that you look and desire to tackle. So that's where we're at. Where we're at.
And so do you have any plans for, I know you're going to focus on other things more so now, but what's going to happen to, say, the Latin dancing and Baila Memphis? Are they going to be, I guess, dead, or somebody going to take, or is your brother going to be involved in that, or people that you know, are they going to help out in those things?
In those organizations? No. Baila Memphis has really been kind of, was on hiatus since 2018. You know, again, I might end up doing some things here and there in Memphis, but it'll be, it certainly won't be the scale of what we did with Baila Memphis or say the Latin dance. But for all intents and purposes, those eras have come to an end. And, you know, again, my hope is we created some memories. We helped support some people on their dance journey. And again, I'm always available and accessible to kind of help people and direct people. But, you know, I feel a little bit more, I don't know, secure in my decision because of the prevalence of options as far as teachers. Like, you know, one of the things that happens with the pandemic is strong increase in whether it's Zoom, Microsoft Teams, or these unique platforms and availability and accessibility of classes. And so like, I'll tell you, like there's a, I've just signed up for some classes myself. Some of it was more on the music side so I could be able to, you know, figure out what the difference is from a rhythm standpoint of a son montuno and a huahuanco versus a bolero versus, you know, any, you know, a pachanga versus a charanga. And so there are all these different things and verticals where it's like, it's out there now because people have had the time to sit down and really think through it and work through it. And so I feel like, you know, those folks who I'm fortunate enough to call my students have some better spaces. And then, you know, if they need to pick up the phone and give me a call like, hey, they explained it this way, there's something broken, help me fix it, I'm always available. I think that's always my role to kind of help push people. My goal was never to be somebody's end all to be at Sensei. It was, again, to give them a platform and then say, you got to go to the next stage to get the next thing. I just wanted to give you a place in the space so that I remember one of my students talking about, like, you know, I kept going to Congresses, and there's somebody who's a veteran. And like, I couldn't pick things up. And they were like, you know, after that level one of your class, you know, I went to ASBF and like, I didn't get it all, but like, I recognized that like all the stuff you were teaching me, these are all just variations on those things. And so I was able to pick up things a lot quicker than I have. And again, this is somebody who's been dancing for over a decade, maybe closer to 15 years. And so to me, like, that's what it was about. That's what it was worth. I knew what I could provide. And I just wish I had the opportunity to share it with more folks.
Yeah, we'll see what happens in the coming years. But I have hope, you know, that things will open up, get better, and, you know, we'll treat each other better. We'll have more inclusion. I do hope that those things happen. Absolutely. And then for the last question I have for you is, what is your favorite genre of music and why?
The answer is I don't have one. That's not a non-answer answer. It's a, my dynamic is always like, it's just very taste in time kind of deal, right? And so like, you know, like I imagine most people are, I'm, you know, I'm like in the space where I'm listening to a lot of Silk Sonic right now.
What is that? Silk Sonic?
Yeah, that's the Bruno Mars and Anderson .Paak.
Okay.
You know, group Leave the Door Open being the song. But like, I'm very much a, like, it's, I'm not moody, but like, it is my energy and my mood that dictates what I want to eat, what I want to listen to. Okay. And so like R&B is always going to kind of be home between R&B and gospel, right? But it's also like, usually there's a certain, like, there's just like set of songs where it's like, It just takes me to a place where it puts me in a place or gets me out of a place. But like in that same vein, you know, I can just be riding around and like, man, I just really want to hear some Play a Fly, right? Or like, man, I just really want to hear, you know, a pachanga. Or man, I just, you know, there's certain things that I maybe more stay away from. So I'm not a huge rock head. That's just not my genre, right? Not big in like alternative and pop music is cool, but you know, it's a little bit vapid for me. And so, you know, I would say it's much more kind of in the R&B and gospel and Latin music. And I would also say like my tastes have changed over time, probably because I listen to a lot of podcasts. So like more so than music these days, I just listen to podcasts because it's about the exchange of knowledge. It's about new ideas. It's about kind of how do you get better or just somebody saying something in a way that I haven't heard it before. And so,
yeah, I resonate with that too.
I guess the only thing I would say is like, if you force me to, you said, Ramel, you can't give this non-answer answer. Like, what's your answer? I'd probably tell you something like 90s to 2000s R&B. I feel like that was kind of my golden age, if you will. And then if you force me as far as artists, he does not fit into it, but it's either Stevie or it's Michael Jackson. It's one of those, but it's probably Stevie just because of his breath and influence. And he just has a, I remember my parents buying a 4-pack of Stevie Wonder music. And like, I think it was called At the Close of the Century. And it's like, he'd already been doing it for like 30 years at that point. And he's still continuing. And he's just one of those idols for me.
All right. And you might go into a bit of detail about like how each, I mean, you probably have like a lot of genres that you like, but you might go into detail about like how each genre of music affects you, like R&B versus mambo versus bachata versus charanga.
Yeah. So I'll just stick it to the Latin music to keep it more brief. Okay. You know, when I think about quote unquote salsa music, and so I'm going to take pachanga and set it to the side for the time. It's kind of all interesting, right? So there's certain things where it feels like I'm very connected to my partner, and it's about just this relationship between me and generally speaking her. There are times in the music where it's just about the music itself, and it's almost feels like it's dancing around you, right? You know, some of it is there's just like social context where it's like I'm kind of trying to figure out what to do with it, because I know even though I'm dancing in a partner dance, the message of this music is not about what we're doing. It's about something bigger. There are some songs where it's like, I can't dance to that song because that song has a very specific meaning. And you know, somebody put an idea in my head and it's like, that thing never leaves me. So it's like, that song, I just have to leave it there. And that'll be when I take my water break, because yeah, there's a different experience with the song, right?
Oh, you're frozen.
So yeah, pachanga is a party. It's about expression. It's about engaging. It's about kind of, I feel like it's kind of like all about me, right? And about that expression. Cha-cha-cha is usually much more, a lot more playful, right? Except for really, really slow cha-chas. That's not my favorite in general, because I feel like those songs are just more expressive than I'm capable of. And so like a song like a K. Leo or El Raton, like those are too slow for my personal preference, right? Mm-hmm. And then for me, bachata is just all about connecting with my partner and kind of living in that experience. Over time, I've kind of taken my style from what's more urban to, again, trending more towards what people call traditional, or it's like they dance on the island. And again, I'm not there perfectly. I still have a lot of work to do. And I expect Carlos Santa and Edwin Ferreras to really help me on that path. But that's where I'm going. And because of that, it's much more about that experience of me and my partner, it's not about me trying to figure out how to create something that my partner enjoys. It's much more of a shared experience. And so it almost feel like I can sometimes with salsa dancing, I think people feel like they have to put on this cloak or this jacket of coolness and create cool things for their partner to do.
Guilty. I'm guilty.
I've been working out of that myself, right? And depending on how I dance with, I still might feel that, right? But with bachata, I'm much farther down the path of saying, like, no, we're just vibing. And, like, if you don't like that experience, that may be more your issue than it is mine. So I'm not necessarily going to take ownership for it.
Okay. All right. Awesome. Well, I guess we're closed there. I mean, I would like to talk a lot more, but I want to respect your time. And we'll just conclude here.
Well, I will say thank you very much for this opportunity, Alex. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you for inviting me on. And thank you for a great convo, man.
Yeah, man. My pleasure. All right. This was episode 3 of the Mid-South Boogaloo Podcast. Vaya, vaya, que bueno, que bueno. De Cuba, de Nueva York, Estados Unidos.